Hello and welcome to Fora Radio on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and online at abc.net.au/rn/Fora Radio. I'm Paul Barclay. Today, should Australia go nuclear? The world's attention this week is focused on the United Nations Climate Change Conference in Copenhagen, and energy is at the heart of the discussion. To shift from a high carbon emitting economy, alternatives need to be found. Will renewable sources like solar, wind, and geothermal be sufficient, or has the time come for Australia to pursue nuclear power? In a timely debate held last week in Perth, advocates and opponents of nuclear energy argued their case to an enthusiastic audience. The debate was organised by two Western Australian senators, Green Senator Scott Ludlam and Liberal Senator Matthias Cormann. Lining up in support of the nuclear option were Professor Manfred Lenzen from the School of Physics at Sydney University, James Eggins, an executive at Paladin Energy Limited, a Perth-based uranium development and production company, and the case for was led by Liberal Senator Matthias Cormann. On the negative, Dave Sweeney, nuclear campaigner for the Australian Conservation Foundation, Irene Kirshenow from Doctors for the Environment, and Greens Senator Scott Ludlam. Nuclear is a proven, reliable, secure, low-carbon emission energy technology. True or false? To open the case for the affirmative, here's Professor Manfred Lenzen. Manfred has a PhD in nuclear physics and 15 years of experience in renewable energy technologies. Manfred Lenzen.
Ladies and gentlemen, sooner than we think, we will not be allowed to rely on our fossil fuels anymore to provide us with our energy needs. In recent years, the news about looming climate change have become worse and worse. And all this as we can continue to keep growing our GDP, our energy consumption, and as we increase our emissions according to the worst predictions. As a consequence, it now seems that we have only one or two decades left to steer humankind onto a near-zero carbon course. Reducing emissions appears more monumental as the years pass. Scientists now say that the world may emit no more than 1 trillion tons of CO2 in order for the world to stay below 2 degrees Celsius of warming. Now, in the first 9 years of this century, we have already used up one-third of this allowance. If we continue to emit like we do, we will have exhausted our slim budget by 2027. This means that we need reliable, low-carbon energy strategies as soon as possible, and we need as many as possible. In the short term, we will not be able to experiment with technologies that are not demonstrated to work. We need to expand those strategies that are proven. Also, we must take utmost care that our societal foundations will not be destabilized during the transition to a low-carbon future. Therefore, we need strategies that are reliable and safe. Tonight, we will argue that nuclear power should be a component of such a strategy. All OECD countries, except for Australia, New Zealand, and Iceland, either have nuclear power or import nuclear power from their neighbours. The UK plans to provide 40% of the country's electricity needs by 2025 using nuclear power. Sweden and Italy recently announced plans to resume constructing new reactors. The US Energy Information Agency projects nuclear power to grow 50% by 2030. The most significant drivers in this growth are going to be China and India, as you may have guessed, but also Japan and South Korea. Many of those countries now embrace nuclear power because it provides them with a secure energy supply. Unlike coal, uranium can be stored in quantities sufficient to run a national power system for many, many years. Also, a high percentage of nuclear power can protect you against volatile fuel prices because uranium fuel represents only a minor part in the overall nuclear electricity cost. The overwhelming evidence is that nuclear power is a low-carbon technology. Assessments to the contrary have been proven wrong. For every kilowatt hour of nuclear electricity, there are 65 grams of CO2 emitted. Now, to put this in context for you, wind and hydro are slightly lower than that. Solar is slightly higher than that. Gas-fired technologies emit 5 to 8 times as much, and coal emits 12 to 15 times as much. Nuclear reactors' ability to provide reliable power is proven. There are at present more than 400 reactors operating around the world and providing 14% of the world's power needs. And we have accumulated more than 12,000 reactor hours of experience. Nuclear power is as reliable as coal fire and hydropower. It can provide firm base load for more than 85% of the year. Now, solar thermal and geothermal could perhaps provide such reliable power. However, both of these technologies currently operate at minuscule scales, and we do not know that they have a large-scale future potential. Even large interconnected wind farms could at most provide about 15% of firm base load. Even if you interconnected all types of renewables over a very large area, say in North Africa, you could perhaps generate 80% firm base load. But nobody has ever demonstrated that we can build such a grid. All this means that nuclear and hydropower are in the short term the only low-carbon technologies that are proven to deliver reliable power. None of these technologies in our portfolio is 100% risk-free. We know that long-term nuclear waste disposal has to be addressed and that there remain small risks of accidents and proliferation. However, these risks will certainly be dwarfed by climate change. We need low-carbon power urgently, but we do not need a final solution for nuclear waste right now. The physical quantities of waste are relatively small, and we can afford to leave spent fuel in interim storage, as we do now. And we can spend the following decades on searching for the best disposal method. If we discarded the nuclear option and relied solely on renewable energy, this would bear the much greater risk of not being able to reduce CO2 emissions quickly and effectively enough, with the consequence of irreversible climate change. And this is an immense risk we can never, ever control. Nuclear power can make and has made a substantial difference to emissions. Nuclear could shoulder at least 5%, if not 10%, of the effort to combat climate change. Why would we discard such an option in the face of such a fundamental threat? A lot has changed over the past few years. Climate change is too grave a risk. Nuclear power must be part of the solution.
Professor Manfred Lenzen from the School of Physics at the University of Sydney. Now to the opening speaker for the negative, Dave Sweeney. He's been active in the uranium and nuclear debate for over 2 decades, and he's currently a nuclear campaigner for the Australian Conservation Foundation. Dave Sweeney.
I'd like to begin tonight by acknowledging the traditional owners of this region, the Noongar people. I think it's important to do so, both as a mark of respect and recognition, and also as a way of acknowledging that it's Indigenous people in Australia and around the world that have and continue to bear the brunt of the adverse impacts of the whole range of the nuclear industry. And the issue of uranium mining, the fuel that makes nuclear power tonight's topic possible, is a big one that's currently facing many Indigenous communities and people in Western Australia. Well, there's some special aspects to tonight's event. Debates are often manufactured. They can be hypothetical exercises in process rather than content. But as Peter said in his introduction, that's not the case tonight. The events of the past few days in Canberra have put this into sharp relief. A nuclear power push is absolutely on the agenda. Not because it's necessary, sensible or desirable, but because as we move into a federal election year, the illusion, the false promise of nuclear will be used in an attempt to cover up the lack of effective action on addressing climate change. This is not an academic exercise. It is a real debate and one with profound implications for the people and the environment of WA. Tonight's event is also special because in large part we agree with our opponent's main contention, but we fundamentally and unequivocally disagree with their outcome. We know that climate change is real and that it's here. And along with Manfred, we know we need to move away from fossil fuels. Indeed, our side of this debate has been leading this awareness and this call, not for years but for decades. But given this, we deeply disagree that nuclear power is the way forward. You do not solve one proven environmental problem by embracing another. We will argue tonight, tomorrow, and beyond that nuclear technology is too slow, too costly, and too dangerous to be an energy source for the 21st century. We will show that nuclear-derived electricity is actually the short-term byproduct of the production of long-lived radioactive waste. We will show that this industry does not make environmental, economic, or medical sense. And we will show that this industry fuels tension and uncertainty, and it retains its links with the proliferation of the world's most indiscriminate weapons of mass destruction. Put simply, if you have the capacity, the technical capacity for a nuclear reactor, you are a dropkick away from the capacity for a nuclear weapon. And if you need proof, then look no further than the world's current concern over Iran's uranium enrichment program. I have never heard of a terrorist group or a rogue nation threatening to detonate a solar panel in the middle of a city. This industry is unsafe, it is unclean, it is unnecessary. And the nuclear debate is incorrectly framed. Our national and global energy choices for the 21st century are not confined to dirty coal and dangerous nukes. Renewable sources today, on planet Earth, on December the 3rd, contribute more to the global energy mix than nuclear sources do, and renewable energy is the world's fastest growing energy sector. So we might be on the negative side tonight, but we absolutely have the positive story. Our choices are not between dirty coal and dangerous nuclear, and the transition, the necessary transition, to a low carbon economy does not mean we have to embrace a radioactive one. And the good news is we have other far better options. Renewable energy systems won't cost the earth. They will be pivotal in helping to save it. It might be useful and helpful to pause and reflect what it is we are actually discussing tonight. So what is nuclear power? Well, let's start with what it's not. It's not cheap. It's not clean. It's not some elegant little USS Enterprise Star Trek-style power pack that sits neatly in the corner and quietly provides no-fuss, limitless power. It's not a bridging technology. It's a bridge to nowhere. Nuclear power plants are capital and energy-intensive industrial facilities. Heat from a controlled chain reaction is used to turn water to steam, to drive a turbine, to produce electricity. The circuitry is complex, but the principle is simple. It is a vessel to create steam, which in turn creates motion, which in turn creates electric power. But it doesn't just create power. It also creates radioactive waste. A typical nuclear power plant produces around 25 to 30 tonnes of high-level radioactive waste each year. And the global fuel load, the global spent fuel inventory grows by around 14,000 tonnes per year. This material is hot, hazardous, very dangerous, and it is irresponsible to create a waste that we cannot manage. And despite 60 years of promises and effort, there is no agreed or proven way to manage this material over the long term. Put simply, there is no solution. There is not one site in one country on earth for the final disposal of high-level waste. Not one. And the industry has just suffered a massive blow with the Obama administration's refusal to allow dumping at Yucca Mountain in Nevada. Nevada, the state that gambles on nearly everything, drew the line at rolling the dice on radioactive waste. And this is a big issue for Western Australia as the uranium industry attempts to get into this state. Mine waste or tailings left behind after mining contain 80% of the radioactivity of the original ore body and are now bioavailable. They can move in wind, they can move in water. They are a secret and silent killer for 10,000 years. And the people of Kakadu, in a passionate plea, the Mirarr people, in a passionate plea for no more uranium mining on their country, said, "None of the promises of this industry last, but the problems always do." We're at a time of choice in Australia, and WA is at the sharp end of that choice. We can continue to contribute to global energy problems by exporting ever more coal and uranium and by following the dangerous distraction of domestic nuclear power, or we can recognise that we can't dig our way out of climate change and instead position ourselves as the world leader in sustainable production and smart use of energy. We and our kids deserve better than a future as a quarry and a dump. Thank you.
Dave Sweeney, campaigner for the Australian Conservation Foundation. You're with Fora Radio on ABC Radio National. Paul Barclay with you. Should Australia go nuclear? That's our debate today. Taking up the argument in support of nuclear power, here's James Eggins, an executive from Paladin Energy, a Perth-based uranium and development production company. James has served as director of the Uranium Information Centre and has worked on various committees of the World Nuclear Association. James Eggins.
Well, good evening. I'm sure you're going to love my presentation. I admire Dave Sweeney. I've been watching his activities, and I'm sure he's been watching ours for a very long time. I'll deal with some of his issues during what I was going to talk about, but the one thing that really struck me first was he said anyone operating a nuclear reactor is a drop kick away from proliferation. And he talked about Iran. Now, that's interesting because the Iranians actually have not commissioned their civil reactor. It's being built by the Russians. It's not operating. And this is an interesting point about proliferation, where we get a crossover in people that have legitimate concerns about the industry but don't draw the legitimate distinctions between the operators of civil nuclear power programs and what governments might do. Now, the rest of it, slow, costly and dangerous. Well, in the time that I've got, I'll try and cover off some of those points. But the proposition that we're arguing tonight really is that nuclear power is proven, that it's reliable and it's a secure, low carbon emission energy technology. What I think we should do before we have a big argument about it is look at exactly where we are. And nuclear power's actually got quite a long history. The first civil nuclear power reactor was called a hall in Cumbria in the UK in 1956, and that was only actually taken out of commercial operation in 2003. Now, for about the last 15 years, nuclear has contributed about 15% of world's electricity production, and it's held that proportion, notwithstanding the fact that there has not been significant reactor builds outside of Asia. Now, the key to this is it's about electricity. Electricity and electrification are a very important part of the changing economy. 40% of primary energy now is consumed as electricity, and the electricity consumption growth rate is about twice the rate of total energy consumption. And all of the models say whatever we do, in whatever version of the world, we're going to continue to consume more electricity. Now, whether you like it or not, nuclear electricity does have a dominant share in many countries. Worldwide, there are 436 plants operating, 370 gigawatts, you can check all of this, 53 plants under construction. But this year alone, there are 8 new plants started construction in China, 1 in Russia and 1 in South Korea. But more importantly, there are 18 countries that are more than 20% dependent upon nuclear. Now, beyond that, as the climate change debate is starting to take traction, a large number of countries, we're starting to see more nuclear plants certainly being planned and certainly being proposed. So what we're actually seeing around the world is a recognition of the performance of the existing nuclear power programs. And this recognition has been quite significant. I have been in the industry since 1981, and I remember very well what happened to the industry at the time. In 1981, it was post Three Mile Island. It was also the second oil shock. 86 was Chernobyl. We had Sweden, which had a nuclear phase-out policy by 2010. Now, Sweden last year abandoned that. Italy had nuclear power plants, shut them down. Last year has abandoned that policy. Belgium compromised to limit operating life of nuclear reactors. That's now been extended. Germany, as we've seen with the last federal election there, they'll be modifying their nuclear phase-out. The UK, there has been a dramatic reversal in attitudes towards nuclear. Now, what does this mean? It doesn't actually mean that the nuclear industry's been out there and aggressively promoting these things. It means that governments have been looking at the facts. And the facts are that nuclear power in many of these countries is a very, very important component of baseload power and meets the constraints of our modern environmental requirements. Now we move to the developing countries, of course, China and India. Everybody's heard that story. The Chinese nuclear commitment is going to be very significant. So will the Indians. But also Korea, Japan, Taiwan are continuing. And, of course, the USA at the moment is on the verge of seeing the first commitments of new plants. So, I mean, the logical question for all of this is going on is absolutely why. Why is this happening? Well, my view is it's very simple. What nuclear offers is very, very large quantities of baseload power generation. It is a low carbon emitter. It's safe and reliable, which I know sounds counterintuitive. The waste itself is actually, don't laugh, elegant. I'll tell you why. Because if you start to demonise carbon and CO2 and you decide that you have to store that in the volumes that it'll be created and the fact that you'll have to store it forever, you'll wake up one morning and have renewed belief in nuclear waste. The other part is natural uranium, which is the fundamental fuel. Some of my colleagues from the mining industry are here now and they will misinterpret this, but overall uranium is relatively abundant. So it's a reliable fuel source going forward. On the issues of cost, yes, nuclear power stations are expensive. The capital cost of a nuclear power plant is considerably higher than an equivalent plant for coal or gas. On the other hand, new plants are built with quite long operating lives. The new plants being built in Finland and Sweden, and if you look at the US plants that have all had lifetime extensions, or what will be the effect in Belgium and Germany, you're looking at plants that will run 60 years. Fuel costs are very, very low. They're highly reliable. You've got countries like France operating 70, 75% of their electricity comes from their nuclear power plants. They are low carbon. There's been a lot of work done on the arguments that the nuclear fuel cycle produces more CO2 than it actually avoids. I think that answer has been resolved quite satisfactorily. On the issue of disarmament, probably what you don't realise is that the nuclear industry in the United States is probably the key vector for deproliferation. Over the last 12 years, under a program between the United States and Russia, there has been the disposal of 15,000 nuclear warheads coming in through what's called the megaton to megawatts program. I'm not dismissive of proliferation. It's a significant issue, but you must understand that proliferation relates to governments, not the industry. Thank you.
James Eggins, executive with the uranium development and production company Paladin Energy. Next up, to oppose the nuclear option, is Irene Kirschenau. Irene is a practicing doctor and active member of Doctors for the Environment. She sits on the executive committee of the Conservation Council of Western Australia. Irene Kirschenau.
As a doctor, I think it's very healthy to be having this debate about whether nuclear is a proven, reliable and secure low-carbon emission energy technology. I have very many concerns about the future of human health in the face of climate change and the diminishing capacity of the Earth to sustain us. But I'm also worried about the way that our choices in dealing with these problems will affect us. Nuclear power seems to me to be part of the very same unsustainable thinking which has helped create our current problems. I'm also not convinced that we're doing no harm to our health if we adopt it. To do no harm, now there's an important principle to which many profit-orientated industries should pay more heed. See tobacco, asbestos, coal, uranium. As H.L. Mencken said, there's always an easy solution to every human problem. Neat, plausible, and wrong. Unfortunately, nuclear power will not go far in addressing our climate emergency, as in fact Professor Lenson has implied, although in his case it's a glass half full. It will distract us from seeking and implementing truly sustainable practices and will bring with it a raft of serious and long-lived health threats. And those threats are because of the unique health effects of radiation. The radiation from nuclear weapons and nuclear energy is uniquely hazardous, persistent and indiscriminate, potentially damaging our most precious legacy, the core human blueprint stored in our DNA and passed on to future generations. The standards of what is considered an acceptable dose of radiation have changed over time. As the health impacts have been understood, the permissible doses for occupational exposure have gone down and down. Low-dose radiation effects are hard to examine by epidemiological means, but our best model is still that there's no safe dose of radiation. When it comes to radiation, there are health problems every step of the way, in mining, transport, nuclear power stations, and nuclear waste. And when things go wrong, it's called a catastrophe. In Australia, we currently have uranium mining, of course, and it's promoted here as well-regulated and posing acceptable risk to miners, the community at large, and the environment. World's best practice and rigorous environmental and health approval processes are said to be applied. Nonetheless, we know there are frequent accidents resulting in environmental contamination and exposure to workers at each link in the nuclear chain. And in this debate, each link is relevant because nuclear power plants need uranium and nuclear power plants create waste. Pound for pound, it's one of the most toxic substances known. In uranium mining, health dangers arise from spillage from tailings dams. 100,000 litres per day is seeping out of the tailings dam at Ranger in Kakadu National Park. Radiation is getting into the water table and into the food chain, and it's a real problem. Then we have incidents such as contaminated water going into the workers' water supply at Ranger, with miners drinking and bathing in water 400 times the legal limit. These types of events number over 100 for Ranger alone, and they're endemic throughout the industry worldwide. We know that there's an excess of lung cancers, other solid cancers, leukemia and hereditary risk posed to workers by exposure during uranium mining. This is described as an acceptable risk, as the individuals involved are reasonably informed, stand to gain directly from their involvement in the industry, and the overall risks appear relatively low. But having said this, because we have no long-term studies of uranium miners' health in Australia, our risk assessment is based on theoretical rather than observed grounds. And we still don't even have a national radiation dose register, which I would consider to be a fairly minimum requirement for appropriate epidemiology of individuals transferring state to state or job to job. So as you can see, proven, reliable and secure, not exactly ringing true. And the water becomes murkier when we consider risk to nearby communities or even worse, future generations who will have perhaps derive no benefit whatsoever from current mining activities, nuclear power plants and storage of waste. So what about health of surrounding communities? Let's have a look again at an Australian example. A 2006 study by the Institute of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Studies reviewed Indigenous health in the vicinity of Ranger uranium mine in the Northern Territory. This study suggested a near doubling of all cancer risk compared with other comparable Indigenous communities in the Northern Territory. The authors called for further investigation, but this hasn't been done. And the long-term health status of these communities with regards to uranium mining continues not to be monitored. So what about nuclear plants? As part of their normal activities, most reactors discharge radioactivity into the environment. Does this cause health problems when things are working properly? A recent study in Germany, commissioned by the German Federal Office for Radiation Protection, looked at leukemia risk in children living adjacent to reactors from 1980 to 2003, and it found an increase in leukemia risk of 120% for children under 5 living within 5 kilometres of the reactor. Although no confounding factors were identified, the radiation dose was claimed to be too small, in theory, to have produced this effect. This again highlights a systemic tendency to make assumptions of safety rather than to adequately define the problem. And no reactor in existence is inherently safe. We can't screen out individuals who might cause a disaster. The results of a nuclear accident could easily be more devastating than Chernobyl in terms of health. What is unique about radiation is how long the accident continues for. Finally, climate change itself brings with it a dangerous mix of elements. I would actually argue that climate change should be one of the reasons not to embark on a nuclear future. Presently, we're on track to exceed 2 degrees of warming, perhaps as soon as in the next 20 to 30 years. At 2 degrees, just to remind ourselves, dangerous climate change becomes likely. What does this mean? Well, we're likely to see a greatly destabilised world, both in terms of climate extremes, but also in terms of food, water, land and resources. It's likely to mean more conflict. Dangerous means dangerous to order and institutions. It means dangerous to the world economy. I'd put that it might be a greatly changed world into which we'll be placing the responsibility of managing mines and tailings, running nuclear reactors, safely decommissioning them and looking after waste. A task plagued by incidents and accidents, even at the best of times. So, is nuclear proven, secure and reliable in terms of health? Or is it all rather wishful thinking? Thank you.
Dr. Irene Kirschenau from Doctors for the Environment. On Fora Radio, I'll return you to our nuclear debate in just a moment and our final two speakers, Liberal Senator Matthias Cormann and Green Senator Scott Ludlam.
Has your town gone a bit quiet? Bring it back to life with the ABC's Revive and Thrive Challenge. Tell us how you'd revive your community and be in the running to share in $110,000 thanks to the Foundation for Rural and Regional Renewal. For details, head to abc.net.au/reviveandthrive. Revive your town this summer and watch it thrive.
You're listening to Fora Radio with me, Paul Barclay, here on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and on the web at abc.net.au/rn/Fora Radio. Today we're at the Perth Town Hall and a debate over whether Australia should go nuclear. The proposition, nuclear is a proven, reliable, secure, low-carbon emission energy technology. True or false? Wrapping up the case for the affirmative is Matthias Cormann. He's a Liberal Senator from Western Australia and for the last 2 years has chaired the Senate's Fuel and Energy Committee. Senator Matthias Cormann.
I'm sure we've convinced you by now of our case, which is that nuclear is a proven, reliable, secure and low carbon emissions energy technology. Yes, have we? I'm sure that everybody tonight has got a completely open mind about the subject matter. And I'm quite happy to be the last speaker of the affirmative team, but the only trouble with that is that Scott will actually have the last word. Now, if I can, I mean, Scott and I, we challenged each other to this debate on Twitter. And, you know, we said we would have a debate based on the facts because we think it's important for the information to be out there and for people to be able to make up their own mind. And I've got to say, I really congratulate Scott and the Greens for being here for the debate because being party political for a moment, the Labor Party has certainly been very absent from this debate. So well done, Scott. And we've been debating this all day today, so this is our third debate today. Now, The challenge that we're facing around the world is really that as our energy needs continue to go up, we are at the same time faced with the challenge of wanting to achieve massive reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. Now, if we're really serious about this, then we really do have to have a very serious look at nuclear energy. And as previous speakers have said, for the last 50 years, nuclear energy has been part of energy generation in countries around the world. In fact, Australia is one of the very few countries in the OECD that doesn't at present rely on or have some sort of, doesn't have nuclear energy as part of its energy mix. Now, Of course, we should be pursuing the full potential of renewables, wind, solar, geothermal, etc., wave energy. Of course we should. Of course we should explore the full potential of clean coal energy technology. Of course we should pursue energy efficiency. But the reality is that given our energy needs moving forward, given the energy needs of our economy moving forward, all of that is not going to be enough. There is absolutely no question that if we want to meet our energy needs moving forward in a way that is environmentally sustainable and that will help us to achieve significant greenhouse gas emission reductions, then we do have to have a serious look at nuclear. Now, a whole series of issues have been raised by the speakers from the negative side. A cost is raised. And, of course, the upfront capital cost for nuclear energy is quite high. Operating costs are very low, and as a previous speaker from the affirmative team has said, nuclear power stations have a very long operating life. Part of the reason why the upfront capital costs are so high is because of the regulatory arrangements being so unpredictable. If investors have to look at very long lead-in times and uncertain approvals processes, etc., all of that adds to the cost. Now, If we wanted to make sure that nuclear became as affordable as possible, the first thing we would have to do is to make sure that we've got a clear, predictable, sound regulatory framework in place within which private investors can come forward and say, okay, well, I'm prepared to put my money on the table and invest in nuclear energy generation. And as long as investors know that they're not going to be sort of having to run around various levels of government for 20 years, I actually am very confident that we would be able to attract that investment. Now, waste, of course, waste is an issue, but let's not overstate it either. There are more than 400 power stations in more than 30 countries around the world, and all of those countries are dealing effectively with their waste. Waste, the volume of nuclear waste is very small. In countries that do have nuclear energy, it is less than 1% of the toxic industrial waste in those countries. And it is being stored safely, and there is technology to store it. Of course, the longer-term technology that we ought to look at is permanent disposal in deep, permanent geological disposal arrangements, and that is, of course, something that is absolutely feasible moving forward. Now, I mean, proliferation gets mentioned, but I just want to make the point very clearly. I'm talking about Australia considering nuclear energy, not getting involved in nuclear warfare. Let's just make that very clear. I mean, our government, we have got a strong democracy, we've got a very stable political system. There's absolutely no way that an Australian government would do anything inappropriate in the context of pursuing nuclear energy options. Now, public acceptance in Australia clearly is an issue. Like, there's no way that we will ever be able to go down the nuclear energy path unless we are able to convince, the overwhelming majority of the Australian people that it's a good idea. And events like tonight are really designed to put all of the facts before you, and hopefully you'll be able to make up your own minds as to whether nuclear is indeed, as we would have argued, a proven, reliable, secure, and low carbon emissions energy technology. But and there is also no way that we'll ever be able to go down the nuclear path unless, dare I say, Scott, unless there's bipartisan support for that proposition, at least from two major parties. I think over time, I'm confident that we'll be able to convince the Greens that nuclear is indeed the most environmentally friendly option around. And in fact, there are a few people, and their names escape me now, but there are a few people that were quite senior in Greenpeace and other organisations that have actually changed their mind in relation to nuclear. And I just point out that the Labor government in the United Kingdom has recently announced that they would invest in 10 additional nuclear power stations. Why have they done this? Because they realised that it was the only way that they could achieve massive reductions in greenhouse gas emissions in that country. And of course, we would be able to do the same here in Australia. Now, we do have to make sure that as we go down this path, once there is public consensus, and I'm confident that that public consensus will eventually emerge, that when there is such a public consensus, we do have to put a sound, a clear and predictable regulatory framework in place. And I really welcome the comments by the Premier, Colin Barnett, making suggestions along those same lines. We have to bring experts in from overseas, because in Australia at present we don't have the necessary expertise to develop a nuclear energy industry. But, I mean, once all of that is in place, once we've got the public consensus, the regulatory framework, and, enough expertise in Australia to get things underway, there's actually nothing that would hold us back. Now, I mean, in conclusion, I just want to sort of stop where I started. I'm sure that you all agree that today the affirmative team has made the case that nuclear is a proven, secure, reliable and low-carbon emissions energy technology, and we need to consider it for Australia.
Liberal Senator Matthias Cormann. Now, to conclude the case for the negative, here's West Australian Green Senator Scott Ludlam. He's the Green spokesperson on nuclear issues and has been campaigning for a nuclear-free Australia for over 10 years. Senator Scott Ludlam.
Just maybe test the theory that this side has won. Can I just get a bit of a sense from the room at how this side's doing so far? Yeah, I thought it was worth asking. It's interesting that Peter led before the example of Rum Jungle as a bit of a symbol of the bright, optimistic future that the nuclear industry had in Australia. Rum Jungle today is a radioactive sacrifice zone. It's one of the worst examples of mine rehabilitation gone bad. It contaminated 40 or 50 kilometres of the East Finnis River. The taxpayers are still paying to assess how to clean up that site. And so that's probably an appropriate place to start. In any rational debate, the issues surrounding uranium mining and nuclear power, I think that the arguments that my colleagues have put on the table already should really have finished the conversation. Any energy source with a footprint as damaging as the one we're considering tonight should be written out of the picture already. But we keep hearing persistent rumours of a global nuclear renaissance, and it really is worth having a bit of a look at it. If there's a surge in construction around the world, and Australia is missing out on that, we really should take a proper look and find out if there's something going on that we need to reassess. So that's really what I wanted to do tonight, is take us for a very rapid trip around the world and find out how this nuclear renaissance is actually playing out in practice. It might surprise you to know that peak nuclear was 2002, and I'm putting a proposition to you tonight that as of August 1, 2009, there are 435 commercial power stations operating around the world. That's 9 less than there were in 2002. The proposition I'm putting to you now is that the nuclear industry has gone into its terminal decline from which it will never recover. It's never going to regain those levels that it had in 2002, and there's some very important reasons as for why that's the case. No startup was actually reported in the last 2 years, so the proportion of nuclear energy in the global energy mix is declining, as are the numbers, because a lot of these things were built in the 60s and 70s. They're getting too dangerous to run. They're now being retired faster than we can afford to rebuild new ones, and that gradual decline that kicked off in 2002 is about to become quite steep. And it's my strong contention, based on the numbers, based on what's actually happening rather than wishful thinking, is that that decline is irreversible. The regulatory delays that Senator Cormann talks about, they occur for a reason, and they're occurring right now in the UK with the 10 reactors that he mentioned before. The regulators have already stepped in and said, you cannot build those here. They are not yet safe enough to be licensed. And that is the reason why the last reactor that went online in the US took 25 years to build. By 2015, probably, just on law of averages and on the average shutdown time for commercial power stations today, there'll be 10 fewer reactors operating than there are now. No sign of renaissance there. In the following decade, another 174 will have to be built just to break even. As the units that were brought online in the 60s and 70s get too dangerous, too brittle to run, they must be closed down. And these are fairly optimistic assumptions. There's a wonderful study done by a fellow called Michael Schneider for the German government, which I certainly commend you to if you want to dig into these figures. Why is the industry in such a decline? We'll come to some of those reasons. The first one you might be surprised to know is cost. And economics is what's killing this industry. The anti-nuclear movement globally is playing its part, but actually it's the formidable cost of building, licensing and maintaining these things that is the industry's Achilles heel. In the 70s, the early 70s, it cost about $750 per kilowatt to build a power station. By the late 1980s, that had risen to about $3,000 per kilowatt. Current estimates are around $7,000 per kilowatt, but nobody knows how high the costs are. They're open-ended because they are no longer being built in the Western world. Wind, just by comparison, $2,000, solar $3,000, so less than half the average estimated cost of a new nuclear build. And, of course, the fuel costs for renewable energy technology is zero. Capital intensive, but once you build it, the fuel costs you nothing. No nuclear power station's ever been built in a deregulated energy market anywhere in the world because investors will not touch something with open-ended costs and liabilities. You have to pass off the insurance bill to the taxpayer, which is what's happened in North America. Presumably these folks will be asking the Australian government to step in and do that here if the industry ever starts up. And there are a lot of ways in which governments overtly or covertly have to subsidise nuclear power to make the numbers stack up. To go around the world very rapidly, peak nuclear in Europe was long ago as 1989. There were 177 reactors in 89, now there's 144. So ask ourselves, if it's so popular there, why are they closing them down so much faster than they can be rebuilt? There are phase-outs underway in Spain, Greece and Germany, and highly contested phase-outs. If this technology is so popular, why are there such organised senior political movements at all levels, from the grassroots right up to senior levels of politics, in places like Belgium and Sweden, where the industry is so popular, the argument is about phasing it out entirely? They're in really huge trouble in Finland with the kind of flagship of the new generation of reactors, which is now 3 years overdue, 55% over budget. The budget there has blown out more than 3 billion euros, and that project is in really big trouble. In Japan, a very severe earthquake shut the world's largest nuclear power complex down in 2007. That hasn't reopened. The industry's in real trouble in Japan. In the United States, where the nuclear renaissance is into its seventh year, the Bush-Cheney administration put billions, tens of billions of taxpayer dollars on the table in overt and covert subsidies. The number of units under construction in the US, zero. Of the 26 applications that were submitted to the regulator since 07, 9 have been cancelled or indefinitely suspended. Another 10 are in trouble. And so the industry's in a real crunch. You can either relicense old units to sit for 60 or 70 years, or you can undergo a very rapid build as they're doing in China and risk the kind of disaster that we saw in Chernobyl. Three Mile Island, the one they almost lost in Pennsylvania in 79, 140,000 people evacuated over a period of a weekend while authorities decided whether or not they needed to pull a million people out. One reactor, one accident. Chernobyl, same situation in 1986. One accident at one power station forced the evacuation and resettlement of 330,000 people, and credible death tolls go from 4,000 to as high as 500,000, depending on whose numbers you trust. And I would like to know from the pro-nuclear side, where do we plan on building these things in Australia and how much will they cost? It's not the vision that I or the folk on this side of the table see for WA, the Saudi Arabia of sunlight, wind, waves and deep geothermal power. This is what the 20th century energy network looks like, not a series of radioactive holes in the ground. See you at the Walk Against Warming on Saturday, and don't forget to bring your blue shoelaces.
Australian Green Senator Scott Ludlam. And that concludes tonight's debate. Nuclear is a proven, reliable, secure, low-carbon emission energy technology, true or false? Our thanks to Ian Manning and ABC Radio in Perth for recording that event. Audio of the entire debate, including final remarks, as well as questions and comments from the audience, has been posted on Senator Scott Ludlam's website. We'll have a direct link to it here at Fora Radio at abc.net.au/rn/Fora Radio. That's about it for this week, but next week on Fora Radio, something completely different. You'll be hearing from musician, songwriter, author and critic Robert Forster. Robert was a member of the critically acclaimed Queensland rock band The Go-Betweens. Since then, he's pursued a solo career in music and more recently become a writer on music. He's just released a new book, The 10 Rules of Rock and Roll, based on his writing for The Monthly magazine. And next week on Fora Radio, he'll talk about it as well as play some tunes for you. So I hope you can join me for that next week. I'll be back with you tomorrow for another Australia Talks, when we'll be looking at childcare. For many parents, it's an unavoidable fact of life. but picking the right childcare centre can be potluck. Well, that's about to change under new national standards that will include lower staff-to-child ratios, better trained staff, and a quality rating system. So, will it improve the care our children receive, and at what cost? Look forward to hearing from you tomorrow on Australia Talks with me, Paul Barclay. Bye for now.
I think a lot of this is made much more difficult as a consequence of negotiating under the auspices of the United Nations.
As officials gather to discuss a new global deal on climate change, Rear Vision looks back at the negotiations for the Kyoto Protocol.
The single biggest difficulty was that any commitment to be negotiated would not involve developing countries.
That's Rear Vision, and you can download or stream this program from the Radio National website.